Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we will have a conversation about Maya Angelou and her life on the show coming up. And, of course, we all mourn the death of that great human being on our planet. We're now here with Dave Zirin, host of The Edge on Sports Radio, sports editor of The Nation, author of many books. His latest is Brazil's Dance with the Devil, The World Cup, The Olympics, and The Fight for Democracy. He's coming to Baltimore to discuss his book and more at Red MS tomorrow night at 7:30 at 30 West North Avenue. You can get more information at redms.org. That'll also be on our website. We'll say it again. And Dave, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hey, it's great to be here. I'm obviously, like I'm sure some of your listeners, reeling from the news about Maya Angelou. She was a professor of my wife at Wake Forest University.
Really?
So this hits close to home, yep.
Well, she was an amazing human being and a kind of a revolutionary fighter to the end, even though she spoke at the president's inaugural, she never forgot who she was. We'll say that.
That's certainly true.
So, Dave, let's talk a bit about the bunch of things you talk about. But before we talk about this book you've written, which I'm in the middle of and really, really like and look forward to having you back on just to talk about that book in toto. And I'm glad you're coming to Baltimore. You wrote this piece that I thought was really, really, really hit the mark. It was called Pure Poison, the UCSB shooting, Ray Rice and the Culture of Violence Against Women, which you just talked about. But you're combining that with looking at what we just did in Baltimore with Ray Rice, the Ravens player, I think is critical. Talk a bit about what you wrote.
No, absolutely. I mean, first and foremost, I think when we have these discussions, we need to separate the issue of violence against women from the issue of what we do to create a culture of violence against women, where women feel like they can't come forward, women feel like they can't speak out, and women feel like their abusers are going to be validated by the broader society. Because that's what we need to work against, that's what we need to fight against. Because, you know, you can't, just like, let's use Ray Rice and his wife, Jhené Rice, as an example. I mean, we know from video footage and we know from their own words that Ray Rice knocked her unconscious, dragged her by the hair in a hotel. We know that Jhené Rice publicly apologized for her role in that event. And the fact that any woman would apologize for being knocked unconscious is a tragedy unto itself. Now, they have their own pathologies. They have their own relationship. I'm not commenting on that. I'm commenting on the fact that the Baltimore Ravens organization said that it would be a good idea to live tweet their press conference and include quotes to make Ray Rice look like he's apologizing to the fans, and Jhené Rice to say, well, it was my fault too, as a way to basically massage the public relations for Ray Rice's return to the team. And I wish we could say this was just a Ravens problem, but this is an NFL problem. I mean, the NFL is a league that constantly looks the other way when there are instances of violence against women, that never discusses it, the fact that multiple players are involved in it. And once again, there are a lot of reasons for this. I mean, some link it to the issues of head injuries and the violence of the sport and bringing that violence home. Other people link it to issues of entitlement that comes with, you know, being deified as a pro athlete. I'm sure every situation is distinct, yet what's not distinct is the way in which the NFL does not address this issue. And that's what's so bothersome about it, because what that does is it projects a cultural message, particularly to the overwhelmingly young men who watch and enjoy this incredibly powerful cultural platform that is the National Football League. And so the NFL, which is so image conscious, and this is one of those cases where they actually openly and nearly proudly choose to look the other way and actually validate through their inaction instances of violence against women.
Yeah, as we move on to the book and you're coming here to Baltimore, I didn't realize this until I read the piece you wrote yesterday morning, that the Ravens actually tweeted out, Jhené Rice says she deeply regrets the role that she played the night of the incident. That was, to me, when you wrote that, and I then looked back further about it, I was just totally flabbergasted, shocked and disgusted that that's what would be put out.
It's very upsetting on any level that she would say this. it's even more upsetting that, remember, the Ravens Twitter feed, you know, that's 500,000 people following their Twitter feed. And they might as well just be saying she had it coming.
Right.
I mean, that's the message that the Ravens are sending out. And it's so clearly a way, and the Ravens have been sending this message since the video first emerged of Ray Rice hitting his then fiance, now wife. Is, you know, they've been saying, well, the team would never suspend Ray Rice, pillar of the community, we want him in back, open arms, nothing changes our relationship with Ray Rice. Now, let me be clear, all of that may be true, but there certainly are ways in which the National Football League and the Ravens organization can send a message that violence against women is utterly inappropriate. And I just, every time these incidences take place, I keep thinking about Javon Belcher of the Kansas City Chiefs, who first killed the mother of his child with a handgun, and then he goes to the team headquarters and takes his own life in front of his coach, Romeo Crennel, and general manager Scott Pioli, and then they play the game the next day as if nothing had happened.
Right.
And right. Other than NBC, none of the football broadcast partners of the NFL even mention the circumstances of Javon Belcher's death. Now, you compare this to, say, the bullying incident in the Miami Dolphins locker room, where a lot of people said, when Richie Incognito bullied his teammate Jonathan Martin, and a lot of people said, well, wait a minute, don't overgeneralize, this doesn't happen in every locker room. And the response of the NFL was, if it happens only once, that's one time too many. Because the image of the shield, that's what they call the NFL, the shield, the image of the shield is at stake. I mean, my goodness, if one time with a bullying locker room situation is one time too many, why isn't one time, two times, 20 times, 100 times of incidences of violence against women involving the NFL not enough for the NFL to actually say or do something?
Well, it just says a great deal, and I think that it opens the door even more for our discussions about just masculinity and professional sports and the what is acceptable and not acceptable. And I deeply appreciate what you just wrote, and I think thank you. We're going to post that on our website, The Pure Poison Piece.
And obviously what I'm trying to do is I'm making a connection between what happened at the University of California,
right,
Santa Barbara, where this deeply disturbed misogynist goes on, and racist too, goes on this killing rampage. And it's like several people have said to me, like, well, how dare you say this? I mean, would you also blame Marilyn Manson for Columbine, blah, blah, blah. And it's so crazy to me that people who sort of produce our culture, the people who are involved in, you know, whether it's Hollywood or the music industry, people who are involved in mass commodification of our culture, they get so defensive, or comedians who make rape jokes, they get so defensive about the role that they may play in producing our collective culture. Because what is culture except our sort of collective intellectual space in which we walk? And you have giants like Maya Angelou. Would we ever say that Maya Angelou did not positively affect our culture,
right,
with her writings? Of course we would never say that. That's why people are crying right now, because of the passing of an 86-year-old. It's people are still weeping because of the positive effect she had on our collective cultural space. If someone could have a positive effect, why do we deny that someone might have a negative effect? And things like normalizing rape or violence against women can actually have very, very, very real life repercussions.
Dave, let me ask you this about the book you've just written and why you're coming to Baltimore to talk about this book. And you'll probably be talking about this issue as well that you produced in your piece you did yesterday. But it's interesting. We watch what goes on in Brazil with these demonstrations, I guess, what people who watch nightly news do, though it's not covered that intensely. Talk first about, before I get into the whole thing about you're going down the favelas and how you got these stories and what you discovered and your frustrations and with all that, is that why we as Americans should even care about what's happening in Brazil?
I mean, that's a great question. I mean, first and foremost, the story in Brazil is a story about priority and the story about the ways in which sports, and particularly the building of sports infrastructure like stadiums, can be a real pull away from other pressing needs that a community may have. Now, if that's not a Baltimore story, I don't know what is. So in a lot of ways, there's a huge echo, not just Baltimore, of course, but the entire former Rust Belt of the United States, whether you're talking about Cleveland, Detroit, Milwaukee. I mean, what do you see in these communities? You see the death of industry and the rise of these huge stadiums, which are like these monuments to corporate welfare and really very low-paying service industry jobs that are seasonal in nature and have no workers' rights whatsoever. And what's happening in Brazil, which is so fascinating, is, you know, people have been angry about this issue for years, Mark. I've been on your show and spoken about it before.
Right.
But here's a situation where you actually have mass protests, a million people in the streets standing up to these priorities. I mean, and so that makes it, I mean, just beyond historic. I mean, that makes it critical.
So you went to Brazil, and you, because of this was going on, you went right to the favelas and you talked to people who are part of left-wing movements. And what did you find when you went to the favelas? That's fascinating to me, because there's a connection but disconnect in some ways between the left in Brazil and what's actually going on in the poor communities.
Mm-hmm. Right. And this issue of the coming World Cup and the priorities of it are starting to build those bonds. I mean, what I saw in the favelas, first of all, let's talk about what I saw, and then I'll tell you what people told me. What I saw was not the kinds of communities that I expected, because like a lot of people, I had believed that favelas and slums were interchangeable words. And you see that a lot in the U.S. media, where they say, like, police raided slums known as favelas. And favelas are not slums. Yes, there's a lot of poverty in the favelas, and no, I don't want to romanticize that poverty. But it is a fact that these are communities where people have invested a lot of time, a lot of money, and a lot of pride into their homes. And, I mean, and a lot of conceptions people have are really misconceptions. Like, for example, 40% of the favelas are online, for goodness sakes. I mean, that means people are these communities, which are so impoverished, I mean, people are connected to the world. And a lot of what we know about the favelas and the attacks by the Brazilian military in advance of the World Cup are done because of citizen journalism, Mark, of people, like, getting online and telling their stories.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I saw, which was really striking. And what I learned listening to people was that Rio, in particular, is undergoing a real estate speculation boom. It's one of the most expensive cities to live in the world now. And, I mean, the housing prices in Rio, the rental prices, would make people in San Francisco blush. I mean, it would really shock people to know how expensive it is to actually live there. And here is all this property on the hills that people own, but they don't own in terms of, like, having any sort of written claim to it. They own it, and you got to put own in quotes, because Brazil has some of the most stringent squatters' rights laws in the world, because that's where the poor, particularly ex-slaves, came to live after the abolition of slavery, and they lived in rural areas and in mining communities, getting diamonds and gold, and they came into the cities looking for work and settled on these hills. And in the name of the most basic social cohesion, Brazil, whether they existed in a state of democracy or dictatorship, respected the fact that these were these people's homes. Well, that one of the reasons they also respected it is that Brazil's economy, particularly its real estate economy, has been stagnant for decades. And yet now it's blowing up. And now, like, think about the United States, where, and most places on earth, where the wealthy live on the hills. Beverly Hills, Bel-Air,
right,
you know,
right,
what I'm saying?
Right.
You live on the hill, not the valley. And here is Brazil with all these emerging millionaires and billionaires and oligarchs, and they're seeing that some of the most beautiful property is owned by the poorest people. And so they need a pretext to remove them from their homes for the purposes of real estate development and speculation. And the World Cup and the Olympics provide one hell of a pretext, one hell of a hammer to do that.
Well, I'm going to get a couple of phone calls here, but I have a real direct question about how this may affect Brazil and what these protests might do or not do. And because to me, it's just fascinating because you watch Brazil as a soccer-crazed nation. Well, people are standing up and how it was kind of... Well, let me do that first and we'll go right to the phones. Gary and Ernest, I want to get to your calls. But let me just say this. I mean, because one of the things you saw here as you wrote about was this how the explosion occurred around the rising of bus fares and then it's kept on growing.
Mm-hmm.
Because the contradictions between kind of a left government and what was actually happening on the ground.
Yeah, and that's such a huge part. You know, one of the reasons, Mark, I got to just tell you why I'm really glad I'm going to be speaking at Red Emma's tomorrow at 7:30, is I'm going to speak, but then we're definitely going to open the floor up and have a lot of discussion because this is complicated. I mean, and in doing the book, that was the most challenging chapter of trying to explain how you have a workers' government with so many hopes by the poorest people that actually has done some good things to fight starvation, inequality, extreme poverty, yet at the same time also operates full scale with the IMF, the World Bank,
right?
And how that contradiction is really catching up with itself in Brazil and how the World Cup is providing a kind of national focus for all the problems that people have had with the Workers' Party.
So let me open the phones here for us, Dave. Get a couple of thoughts in here. 410-319-8888. Gary, you're on the air. Hi, Gary.
First of all, I want to give props, live in power to Maya Angelou. That hit me like mm-hmm. a ton of bricks. And I want to encourage as many of my friends and relatives as possible to come to Red Emma's tomorrow night at 7:30 to listen to a giant of a man, Dave Zirin. I've read every one of his books. I've seen the documentaries. He's a friend. I consider him part of my family. You too, Mark. Want to interrupt your talk since it's already truncated because of the breaking news. But I want to encourage all my friends and relatives to come out and help me celebrate my birthday at Red Emma's tomorrow night. And you guys take care. Bye-bye. Yeah.
Happy birthday, Gary.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
All right. 410-319-8888. And Ernest, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning, Ernest.
Yeah. I want to make it plain that I'm against violence against women of any kind. I think any man that puts their hands on a woman is out of control. That's no excuse for it.
Okay.
But I found out that it's when you report against Ray Rice, it was pretty different when Mark Shamour was charged with raping a 18-year-old child. He played for the Green Bay Packers. He raped an 18-year-old child at a prom
party. Darren Sharper. You talking about Darren Sharper or Mark Shamour?
Mark Shamour.
Oh, yes.
I didn't hear this outcry about mm-hmm. the same kind of outcry. And I didn't hear the outcry when the Washington Capitals, four players, raped a girl in a limousine. And they were getting ready to go to the finals of NHL playoffs. Even Abe Pollin, and when they had the families at the banquet, they asked him, say, what about this rape of this 17-year-old girl by these four players? I doubt if you can give me their names. He said, I haven't heard anything about a rape. It was an ongoing investigation. My point is this, Mark, that every time a white black person gets charged with something, like everything, it's always blown out of proportion over and over and over again. And when black people are involved in things framed in the criminal justice system, you got 70 cases where black males and white males were framed up in New York. Nothing said about it. The detectives not even tried. And the people been the state's attorney are letting people out because of the over and over testimony.
So let me, Dave. I think why don't you respond to that? I think that's a very real issue.
Yeah, a couple things. I mean, first of all, I mean, very quickly on the Mark Shamour case. I mean, who's the Green Bay Packers? I mean, that case I mean, one of the things that highlights is a real difference, I mean, in the media as existed over time. Mark Shimura was accused of this, I believe, in 2000. I mean, so this is before, this is in 2000. I mean, I wasn't even writing about sports then. And this was a time when you had much more, and I think race plays a huge part in this, but another thing that plays a part in this is the sort of corporate vertical integration of sports writing that still existed in 2000. I mean, you weren't going to get published writing about violence against women in 2000. I mean, so, and that's part of it. That's a huge part of it. And not to mention the fact that since sports writing, that's the corporate vertical sports writing, overwhelmingly white, overwhelmingly male, there's no question that racism has always existed in terms of who gets called out and who does not. And Shimura is a really strong example of that in that particular case. But also you just didn't have the voices that you have now willing to not only stand up, but also having the access to being published and being heard. That being said, and just very specifically, it's like I'm someone, and I think we all need to do this. I mean, violence against women does not know color. Violence against women is something that exists in every community. It exists in every community because of frankly, of sexism and how that operates in our society. And it needs to be stood up to in every possible circumstance. And we also do need to be very mindful about the ways in which the press sees some violence against women as more worthy of discussing than others. And race plays a huge role in that, without question.
So we only have a couple minutes left in this segment, and I just want to close out here with you to just talk about tomorrow night and encourage everybody to go to Red Emma's at 7:30 tomorrow night to hear Dave Zirin come speak about his latest book. Because I think the connections are very deep between this huge, gigantic country, which is bigger than the United States of America, the International Federation, FIFA, of soccer, and this kind of Brazil wanting to make itself into a global power, and how it's destroying poor people while promoting this, spending hundreds of millions of dollars on building these stadiums. So there's a lot going on here that I know you're going to cover tomorrow night. So
it's a wild story. So please come. 7:30 p.m. at Red Emma's. I'm very honored to be coming to Red Emma's. Once again, 7:30, talking about Brazil's Dance with the Devil in Baltimore, and I can't wait to be there.
So that's tomorrow night. Do not miss Dave Zirin, host of Edge and Sports, Sports Editor of the Nation. We're talking about his book, Brazil's Dance with the Devil, the World Cup, the Olympics, and the Fight for Democracy, tomorrow night, 7:30 p.m. at Red Emma's, 30 West North Avenue. Just go to redemmas.org for all the information, or go to steinershow.org and click on all the information. We'll have it there as well. Thank you so much, Dave.
Thank you.
Always. We're going to take a break and go out with an excerpt from Maya Angelou's And Still I Rise. Rest in peace, Maya Angelou.
Everyone in the world has gone to bed one night or another with fear or pain or loss or disappointment. And yet each of us has awakened, arisen, somehow made our ablution, seen other human beings, and said, morning, how are you? Fine, thanks, and you? It's amazing. Wherever that abides in a human being, there is the nobleness of the human spirit. Despite it all, black and white, Asian, Spanish, Native American, pretty, plain, thin, fat, vowed or celibate, we rise. You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the very dirt, but still like dust, I'll rise. Does my sassiness upset you? Why are you beset with gloom? Just because I walk as if I have oil wells pumping in my living room. Just like suns and like moons, with the certainty of tides. Just like hope springing high, still I rise.